All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Hey, Sandy, let's talk about the economy. And even though the war is horrible, man, where are we at in the coming months? You know, the summer rolls around, and it's nice to have some money during the summer. It's always nice to have some money, even during the, you know, at any point in time. But people like to have it during the warm weather and be able to vacation and all those things. But these things are going to be affected, right, with inflation and...
Well, yeah. I mean, the inflation, first of all, you can, to segue from the war is obviously going to create an impetus towards more inflation with food shortages and fuel shortages caused by it. You know, in fact, when a world really gets into a wartime economy, I think yesterday or Friday I mentioned something about ration books. But even during the tail end of Vietnam and in the beginning of the oil embargo, there were price controls, which, you know, is an effort by the government to avoid inflation by controlling the rate at which prices can rise.
Do you see that coming?
No, I mean, it doesn't work very well. So, you know, it was replaced by ration books in World War II because price controls are difficult to enforce and create all kinds of artificial problems. But what's happening now is a difficult thing to look at and not get pessimistic about what might happen to the economy, because we have sort of a hot economy. We've got money enough in people's pockets to give them the opportunity and the ability to bid prices up. And in fact, prices have been going up at a much faster rate. If you include fuel and food, it went up over 8% in the most recent 12-month historic period. The last month was sort of better than that, because if you took out food and fuel, which are the most volatile of the price things, it was going up at an annual rate of about 3.6%. So some economists like looking at that. That's kind of the rose-colored glasses data. But the fact is that prices are going up quite rapidly, and the most recent interest rate information would suggest the same thing. Well, when interest rates rise, it dampens the economy, and the Federal Reserve, about the only tool, effective tool they've got, other than, well, they have two tools, but the one that's most talked about is their ability to increase interest rates, and they're rather aggressively at that process. So in the early part of inflation, it's because people have money in their pockets to bid prices up. Prices start going up. Now the way to make sure that prices don't continue to go up is to essentially take the money out of those people's pockets. Well, since most of the consumption in this country is carried out by most of the people in this economy, the consumption in this economy is not carried out by the top 10% of the people. It's carried out by basically the other 90%.
Right.
And so if those people no longer are afforded the opportunity to have the money in their pocket to bid the price up, that means they don't have enough money essentially to buy all that they would have bought otherwise. So that's called hardship. And it is true that the tools to fight inflation inflict more damage on the poorer people and the people less able to absorb it in the economy.
But they bid that up via credit, right?
Well, some of it's bid up by credit, and some of it's bid up by the fact that their wages have gone up. I mean, the last year had real wages going up at a rate faster than inflation. Now, that's not going to continue forever. And in fact, the rate of wage increase has slowed down. But we have housing. You know, the rate of price increases in housing has been like a frenzy. And so housing costs are going up dramatically. Clearly, the American public has decided they're willing to spend a higher percentage of their income on housing than they have in the past, based on the extreme rate of increase in the price of housing. So, you know, things are get prices only go up when people have the money in their pocket to pay for it. Some of that is paid for with credit. That credit gets harder to get when interest rates go up. That's one of the reasons we jack up interest rates, is to make it very much harder for the public to borrow money so they have less money in their pocket to buy things.
So right now, Sandy, still the housing boom, when you talk about, you know, reselling properties and those kinds of things, that's still pretty hot. But if we do know what's coming, and the first thing that's going to be impacted and affected with recession is going to be housing, what happens then? Because you know, there's a shortage of those right now.
I mean, the first things that happen really are durable goods that slow down. You don't buy the washer or dryer that you can get a couple more years out of your old one. You defer buying a new car. The things that have a lifespan of multiple years that you can stretch the life of your current one so you don't have to replace it. So those things slow down. And then housing does too, although apartment housing, which is probably what's being the lowest 50 percentile of people in this country, probably depend on rented housing. So here's the problem is that it's very hard to slow down an economy and put some brakes on without having it tip over into recession, because when you slow down an economy, the inventories that people have built up in the people who are in business and have inventories become excessive inventories, and instead of buying fewer of what they bought to put in inventory, they buy none of what they bought because their inventory can carry them for more time. So you end up that this whole inventory phenomena causes the swing in demand to be much more dramatic than the swing in demand that's happening out there in the marketplace.
And then that creates layoffs?
That creates layoffs because when the people with inventory stop ordering anything, then the people who make it have to slow down what they're doing to try and keep pace with this reduction in inventory demand, and they have layoffs. And when you have layoffs, now you've got less money on the side to buy things, and
now people are really hurting.
And people are hurting then. And so the pill for a hot economy is unfortunately taken disproportionately by the people who can least afford to take it. And that's one of the sins of having an economy in which the rich get richer and the poorer people, like I was saying earlier, there's a lot of people in this economy who are currently living financially insecure, even though we're in a hot economy. And that those 50% of the people who I would bet, if we took a survey, would indicate that they are today financially insecure, will become financially more insecure and feel financially more endangered when we end up having inflation that requires the treatment of higher interest
rates. So help me understand it, because, you know, this is elementary to a lot of us, and we don't understand it. But if the recession comes, I mean, when the recession comes, and inflation is where it is, during the time that the recession is there, what happens to inflation?
Well, there's this thing called stagflation, which is a circumstance that we had in the late 70s in which there was substantial inflation. The country had gotten used to an inflation psychology. And so portions of the economy continued to inflate at a material rate at the same time that we were experiencing a recession. So you had this stagnated economy. If it wasn't a recession, it was a no-growth economy. So if you have no growth in the economy and prices going up, you have the impact of damaging people's pocketbooks.
And a longer-term recovery, I would think.
Well, the problem for that was that it took a while to hit inflation over the head with a hammer. So we ended up it took more than a day or two. Interest rates didn't just plummet when they started this process. So interest rates got all the way up to 15 or 16%.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And then they stayed there for a while. And they didn't get all the way down to 2% until 2008.
So what's new now? I mean, are there new ways to attack it, or are we talking again a decade or more?
Well, you know,
or is that unpredictable?
Well, World War I was the war to end all wars, and it obviously didn't end all wars. And similarly, there's a sort of an arrogance amongst the economists of the world that they think they have become so much more sophisticated at controlling the business cycle that, you know, we've had the depression to end all depressions or what have you. And, of course, neither is true. And we end up having recessions, very deep recessions, that come from surprising places that the economists were never able to foresee, like the mortgage-backed security.
Yeah, 2008.
2008. So will we have another deep recession? Well, we could. Can we control recessions better? We do have a more sophisticated knowledge about the tools we have. We have this quantitative easing tool that we used, in which the government bought not only its own debt securities but mortgage-backed securities. It has trillion-plus dollars worth of these securities that it now could sell back into the market. The sale of those back to the market has an effect of increasing interest rates and depressing
the economy. So, Sandy, hold that thought, because we don't want to miss any of that. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is here. You know, Sandy, I'm asking you all these questions because I remember the pain of 2008. The people who were just devastated. You lost quite a bit of the middle class, their homes in this country, and some never recovered. And now many of the people who don't even know this is coming, you know. And just again, going back to what you've been saying all the time about our country just not missing out and not having conversations with the people who don't even know this is coming.
Well, like I said earlier, you know, you only get hit by the truck you don't see. And so,
but they notice it's coming.
Well, we don't know how deep it is. You know, recessions come in all different forms. Some are very deep. Some are relatively painless. Some are painful. Some are just awful. The 2008 one was awful.
But the interest rates weren't.
No, but it doesn't have to.
I mean, not the interest rates, the inflation.
Well, inflation isn't.
Doesn't have any impact at all.
No. It's one form of the disease. But okay. Well, there's all kinds of economic diseases, and inflation is one of them. The collapse of a financial market is another one. That was 2008, and that had a very broad impact on the national and world economy. So, I wouldn't dare to predict whether, number one, this is going to be a devastatingly deep one. The deep ones are, like I said, the truck that you don't see. And so if you don't see it, you can't really talk about it in advance. But we have set the table for a situation in which it could be problematic. There are, for instance, home values. People who have bought homes in the last 2 years have paid materially higher prices for those homes, or at least the last year, than the market was caring for those houses before. If the housing market goes way down in value as the result of a recession and returns to the values that were prevalent 4 years ago, a lot of those homeowners will be in trouble.
Upside down.
They could be upside down and need to sell their homes. And one of the problems with the 2008 recession was the kind of irreversible effect it had on all these homeowners. I think 70% of the people of Americans who own assets, their primary asset is their home. And it's the primary source of their wealth. And when they lose that source of wealth, they become basically paycheck to paycheck parts of the economy. And I'm confident that what has happened in the 22 years of the century 2000 is that more and more people live paycheck to paycheck in this country, and those people are the ones who feel financially insecure. Those are the people who are socially insecure. That's a part of the social discord in our country, is the extent to which we have a large part of our population who feel financially insecure and endangered. And so, well, I think the problem I see from that standpoint is our next recession is likely to swell the ranks of the people who feel that way. And I don't know how much more we can swell the ranks of people who feel financially insecure and endangered before we get to a socio-political position that is very fragile.
You know, Sandy, you know, some talking with somebody the other day, and says, Earl, you're always talking about these negative things. And I said, well, you call them negative things when they're actually the things we should be talking about because of the pain that they're going. Because there's something that's going to be painful doesn't mean that you shouldn't be discussing it.
Well, you understand that there are hopeful things we could talk about in that would be relating to the same subject. A hopeful thing would be if the government was talking about setting up the kind of social safety net that exists in Europe, because Europe can absorb recessions in a much, much more socially acceptable manner, creating much less social discord than we do because of the nature of what they've built to support their economy. People in this country believe that a social safety net is socialism, that is against and contrary to the notion of a free market economy. My view, and I think the Northern European view, is that a social safety net is the infrastructure you need to support a vibrant market economy.
I was having this conversation with the guy the other day, and he says, Earl, everybody's not hurting in this country. And I said, I get that. You know, I mean, I don't live in a cave. I know that there are people who are doing well. But, you know, and the masses of the people have not always, you know, I shouldn't say that. I lived at a time when the masses of the people in this country did live well, middle class, in my lifetime, in your lifetime. And so I don't know if we can ever get back there.
But you remember that our parents, who were living well in a middle-class economy, had health care from their employer.
So yeah, they did.
They had health care. They had retirement plans.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. And so they were living with a safety net that looked an awful lot like the ones that existed in Europe. We also had a public school system that was working relatively well. So we had education that was going. Because they were living so well, most of the households had only one worker, and they had stay-at-home mothers. So child daycare wasn't the issue then that it is today. So the world has changed, and it's changed materially from what it is that the Trumpians want to go back to making America great again. We can't get that. We can't recreate that. You know, we can't recreate what we just described was the way we grew up, because none of the plans in place by any party would get us all the way back to something like single worker households with making middle class incomes with health care for all.
You know, Sandy, sometimes you forget, because I'm from a family of 13, and my dad worked, owned a home. My mother stayed home. 13 children.
Yeah.
And he was able to work and provide for 13 children.
Well, he was a busy, busy man.
Yes. And so for 13 children.
Yeah.
You just, today, that's inconceivable. That could never, ever happen. And so only through the grace of the time period, did that happen?
Well, and as I've discussed before, the irony of and the uniqueness of this time after World War II, when we were the only people making automobiles in the world, so our automobile workers, the UAW, and the people who were related to it, had wages that were essentially unlimited in terms of the height to which they were able to pay, because all the competitors were operating under the same agreements, and the people who were supplying equipment to the automobile manufacturers like A. O. Smith were unionized and had similar very attractive union agreements, and all of that is not possible today.
So when we come back from break, Sandy, I want you to, just give us from your perspective. Clearly, you're not Nostradamus.
I'm not.
A picture, a scenario of where the nation is really headed. Because if you don't have any of those things that you and I keep talking about, and I just go by what I see from the community where I live, It only gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And then you multiply that by other communities like it all over this nation. Man, I don't know. We got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number as Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I'm so worried about our nation and the people of it, because either they can't see, they're blinded by just day-to-day life, that the nation that we all grew up in and knew is in real trouble. And sometimes we don't see it, especially if we live well, we don't see it. But so many people who are living on the margin and who are living a lifestyle that really America doesn't tout, right? It touts about all the great opportunities and all of those kinds of things, but so many people who haven't been able to take advantage. It's not easy living in this country. I always tell people, we got to stop acting like it's real easy. It's not. You in order to quote unquote make it big in this country, a lot of things have to be lined up for you, and nobody's given anybody anything, so people succeed throughout hard work. But there are others who just don't have, they can do the hard work, but they don't have the mental capacity to navigate a system that is kind of set up for the haves and the have-nots.
Well, and obviously there are these tribal problems. Some tribes have more have-nots as the reason.
Yeah, but even the poor whites of this nation.
Yes,
they struggle.
I mean, I think what the power structure of this country, the ones that are making the laws and talking about what life in this country is like, fail to recognize is the number of people who live paycheck to paycheck. And even if you live paycheck to paycheck in a middle class home, that kind of living is it's a very insecure kind of life.
Right.
One that makes you fearful because you miss two paychecks and you are in a sorry place. And that's what we found out when COVID struck, when people started missing paychecks. That's why we had this huge bailout program for the people of this country, because we realized that people didn't have any cushion. The people were, people up and down the line were living paycheck to paycheck, and without the next paycheck, they wouldn't be able to pay their mortgage, or they wouldn't be able to pay their rent, and they wouldn't be able to pay their electric bills, and the whole thing. So with that kind of fragility in our economy, we've got a social circumstance that worries me. As we go forward into a recession, and as we have the probability that we will enlarge the number of people who live that way, number one, and number two, we'll put more and more of those people into a deficit situation where they aren't quite living paycheck to paycheck, where they have to make a triage decision about whether they pay those electric bills during the moratorium or whether they pay something else and end up at the end of the moratorium, as we did last week, with people with a large built-up electric bill that they suddenly have to pay. You know, that circumstance is going to be one that sociologically is going to create more and more tension in our economy and in our socio-political environment. And so we need to figure out how to get from here to there so that we can ease that circumstance for people, and it needs a social safety net. But as I said off the record, I think the thing we probably really need is the intervention of some real leaders.
You know, you talk about a social safety net. A pension was a safety net.
Yep.
And so many people who had opportunities, you know, with a pension.
Yeah.
And so maybe didn't understand the rule of 72 and all those different things. Everybody does not understand how the financial systems work in this country. Very few people do.
Well, when you think about it, the social safety net is basically comprised of providing services to people that they would otherwise have to save money for above and beyond their daily expenses and their monthly expenses. So social safety net for a pension, you have to see if without some kind of a pension being provided to you, you have to save enough of your paycheck so that when you retire, you aren't earning money anymore. You're simply taking money out of the jar that you saved.
Social security. Social safety net.
Healthcare is something you have to save for. It's like saving for the maintenance on the car that you don't know when you're going to incur the cost, but you might have to. But the healthcare costs are so substantial that if you had to save your own money for it, you could never do it. So then you have to have enough to buy insurance. Well, today you can buy a low-cost health insurance program, but it has a $5,000 copay. And so you're going to have to pay $5,000 plus your insurance premium, and even then you're not going to get 100% coverage. So now you have to save for your pension and for your health care, and you have to set aside money to pay for child daycare, because if you're both spouses are working, you need to pay for that above and beyond. So what have we saddled ourselves with because we haven't built the kind of social safety net that exists in other countries? What we've done is we've created an environment in which if someone doesn't earn $30 an hour in today's world, they don't earn enough money to just get by. And $30 an hour wouldn't allow you to save enough money to retire.
You know, Sandy, I remember when the Affordable Care Act came into existence. And I remember having a goal package. I think the top one was platinum. I had a gold package. And because the company that I was working for, even though all the years that we had paid into it, they decided, well, we can no longer afford this. So here I was at 52 years of age, for the first time starting to get to a point where maybe I needed to have some insurance. Mm-hmm. Some health care, because when you're real young, for the most part, you know, the parts still work pretty good. But now all of a sudden, the company said, well, we can't afford that anymore. Boom, my health care is gone. So for the first time in my life, I don't have health care, because my dad always worked. He always had the health insurance policy, as you talked about. It was part of the package. And now all of a sudden, here I am at 52, no health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act, and I'm all excited about that $5,000 deductible for myself, $5,000 deductible for my wife. And you're thinking, what? And you're paying, I think at that time I was paying $1,000 a month. And everybody celebrated the Affordable Care Act. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yet, but people don't realize, many people don't realize just how difficult it is in this country for so many people. People who worked every day, and then all of a sudden things, as you stated, changed around them. That pension that I know that I receive, it matters, right? Oh, I mean, it matters. And to some, it's all that they have. And then there are people who have tried to take that away. In some instances, they did take that away.
Well, sure. I mean, in fact, from the year 2000 on, industry has been actively withdrawing the group health care that was available to everyone, has been actively withdrawing. They eliminated the defined retirement plans, pension plans, and have moved everyone in the direction of having 401ks where you save for yourself. And the American analysis of 401ks is that very, very few people who have had 401ks have been able to save enough money to provide themselves with an adequate retirement, because the actual amount of money that you have to set aside each year and put into a 401k, if you put in the max that was allowed for the tax purposes, that wasn't enough.
Yeah, and again, not understanding at all how it worked. The average person did not understand. I know when they first came up with 401ks, where I was, people celebrated, and I'm putting the max in, and it's going to be great. And, oh, man, we're going to have all this money when we retire. Well, it just didn't quite turn out that way. You know, I don't know if they made improvements to the 401ks over the last 30 years or not. But, you know, very few people are making enough money, as you stated, to fund them properly.
Right. And you know, I gave the example, someone who makes $30 an hour, that's $60,000 a year gross on a 2,000-hour basis. That's maybe $50,000 or $48,000 after tax. And now you've got to start saving enough for you. You've got to start paying for all the things your family needs today, and you have to save money for a retirement, and you have to pay for health insurance. When you got done with health insurance, you'd only have
$38,000. But, Sandy, you said $30 an hour. If people thought about making $30 an hour right now, they'd think they hit the lottery.
Right.
Because that sounds like so much money. And then you say $60,000. Well, $60,000 a year. What if you got a family?
Right.
You know, mortgage, car. You know, like you said, all those other things, and $60,000 a year puts you in a poorhouse just about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what's wrong with not having a social safety net like Europe had. Because if you earn the equivalent of $60,000 or euros in Germany, you're doing just fine, because you don't have to save for college for your kid. You've got health care provided to you. You have daycare provided to you. You've got a pension arrangement that's going to be adequate for you. You know, you've got things taken care of that allow you to get by. You can even have a holiday with your family.
So what you're saying is it can be done.
Well, sure it can. It's done other places. What bothers me is that the business people of this country can't seem to see clearly that a social safety net along the lines of what exists in Europe is there to be the foundation for a very vibrant market economy. And without it, you're going to end up with a bunch of workers who will kind of meet the Karl Marx prediction of being exploited, because you're going to pay them something that you think is a handsome wage, and they're going to be suffering the consequence.
All right, we've got to go to break. 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. Sandy Williams says, Sandy, you always make me think, man. I was just thinking, $30 an hour. If somebody posted somewhere, we've got jobs available, $30 an hour. Sam shaking her head. Yeah, yeah.
Where do I apply?
I know. and you couldn't, the block couldn't hold the amount of people who would show up.
But I mean, yeah, I know. But then you do the analysis of what that gets you, and particularly if you have a family, if you aspire to have a house, if you're a student who went to college and have a student loan. So what have you got to? So and the 60,000. So let's say that the taxes on it are, let's say it's 8,000. You have 52,000 left. Now you have to buy your health insurance. So what does health insurance cost? Let's say it's $6,000 or $7,000. Now you've got $45,000 left. Now you've got to pay your rent, or you've got to have a mortgage, and you need to save money in order to get a mortgage. So let's say you decide you want to save $5,000 a month. Now you're down to $40,000 a month that you have above and beyond savings.
And this is all without...
I'm talking about a year.
I know, $5,000 a year. And you're not even talking about the taxes that come out of there.
Right. Well, the taxes, I subtracted a too small number of taxes there, which was 8,000. But you get down to 30,000 very quickly in terms of what you have that's disposable to live off of.
And if you got children.
If you got children and you've got rent to pay, it just doesn't get you there. It doesn't. 60. You need to have both spouses working in order to accommodate a family. And so, if you have both both now, you've got to have child daycare, and you've got a bunch of other expenses as well. So, the point is that our economy doesn't have a lot of $30 an hour jobs for a husband and wife to have. We've got an awful lot of people in our economy who are earning in the $50,000 to $60,000 range, who are living paycheck to paycheck. I think the median income in the United States is something like $74,000, meaning that half of the people in this country earn more than 70 and half earn less than 74,000 as a family, which takes into account double income families. And so if you're earning less than $74,000 a year as a family, you are living paycheck to paycheck.
You know, Sandy, you talked about $30 an hour. We talk about educators and teachers. In many instances, teachers start somewhere around $60,000 a year.
They don't start at 60.
Oh, they don't start at 60.
No, that's high. No, they start for less than 60, and it's very compressed. I mean, they wherever they start, it doesn't go up to much higher than 75.
Right.
So it's a very compressed compensation range for teachers. We have a problem. A lot of America, nurses in this country who work very, very hard, who have college educations, only now are they beginning to get pay increases sufficient to beat the number I've described to you as what they're compensated for. I maintain that if someone went out and did a broad national survey, we'd find out that an alarming number of people in this country are forced to live paycheck to paycheck and to make triage decisions every month about the bills they can pay.
And I remember saying this while we were on break. You factor in credit cards and people who got all this tremendous credit card debt. You know, they've been told that you can take the credit card and get whatever it is you want. And, you know, pay the minimum. They've got you set up where if you don't understand any of this, you're a slave. Because you can get the things you want that you really can't afford, but you can get them, right? And you've got, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 credit cards. And the pressure and the interest and all those things really doesn't make it better for you. It makes it worse.
Well, it requires a lot of discipline. And I do agree with the people who think that people, before they get out into the workplace, need to get trained in personal financial management.
No question.
Particularly since we have eliminated healthcare for all through the workplace. So we now have to have people go out and make a reasoned decision about buying a health insurance. So, you know, we've shifted to the individual a great deal of forward planning and saving that wasn't on our shoulders when we were first getting our job. So the ability to pay to save enough for a pension and save enough for health insurance and for these other expenditures requires that you exercise a lot of discipline with your paycheck. And most people are basically required to live under the means that they could live if they didn't save money. And I think so many young people forget about that saving money part and live at the edge of their capacity to live based on their paycheck.
Well, and also because you just don't realize how fast the life is going to move.
Right.
Right? You know, you're young and so you want to enjoy.
Well, we were lucky, too, in that we all got compensation increases during our lifetime that exceeded our expectations.
Yeah.
So we were able to live pretty well, and then the increase in income next year kind of saved us each year.
So, Sandy, were the people who were running things, they were so far ahead of the people running them now, or was it that they were more humane in the way they looked at things? It had to be one or the other.
Well, I think the status of the American economy in the world put the employers in such a powerful position with respect to being able to sell their goods around the world successfully that and they probably were they were less focused on near-term profits, and they were more focused on long-term situational things. Furthermore, as we've talked about in other shows, the people who went to work, we were much more committed to a career at the place we went to work, and the people who hired us were much more intent on providing us with a career so that, you know, in the 1970s, when people took a job, it was a lifelong, probably a lifelong relationship. And in the year 2022, when someone takes a job, it might be for 12 months. You know, or 18 months. It's a resume process because you have to get trained someplace to get the job you want. So your first job is the place where you're building the resume to move on to the job you might want. And it's just a whole different workplace. If we aren't committed to one another in the long term, then we don't tend to treat one another the same way. So employers began to treat their employees much differently, and that led to the loss of pension and the loss of health care and the things that people decided they needed to curtail to control costs.
So, Sandy, it only means that long term, barring some miracle or come to Jesus moment, when this generation gets to be your and my age, it's going to be really rough for them.
It is. That's why I'm concerned. I want there to be the intervention of some real strong, powerful leadership in this country who will open people's eyes with leadership. I think Barack Obama had the promise of being a leader, but as we discussed, I think he was inhibited by his self-consciousness about his color, and he was also hogtied by the Senate, and they were intent on making sure that he couldn't accomplish things. So, but we need real leadership to open up the eyes of people to make us do the things we need to do to create the kind of socioeconomic and political environment that America needs to be a successful place going forward. Because otherwise, we're going to be the stewards who did a bad job of stewardship with what we were handed by our parents.
Well said, Sandy. As always, we got to go. I'll see you on Friday. Thanks to everybody who listened, who made the show go. Thank you, Sam. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.